What's buzzing, Yellow Jackets? Welcome to The Hum in the Hive, a podcast where students, staff, and faculty can come together and discuss the buzz around campus and in our community. I'm your host, Ave Mullen, and it's February. We're going to kick off our very first podcast talking about Black History Month. We have special guests, Alicia McKenzie, who is the Assistant Director of Diversity Education, Mika Nash, who is our Vice President of Academic Affairs, and last but not least, Oshinofa Lokoju, who is President of Pride, Persons Ready in Defense of Ebony. They're going to give us some perspective on the importance of Black History Month and the role it plays in our society today. Nofa, I want to start with you because it's your senior year and you've put together so many cultural moments like the annual Black Excellence Ball and the annual fashion show. I want to know, what do you think the level of involvement is here at AIC since you came in as a freshman up until now?
Personally, I would say that the level of involvement from my freshman year until now has definitely improved. And I would have to say, not to toot my own horn, but toot, that Pride has been quite the trailblazer, so to speak, as far as student organizations go. We try our best to create events that the students will appreciate and hopefully attend. Like last semester, we mimicked an event modeled after the Red Table Talk made by Jada Pinkett Smith, and we were able to shed light on a lot of controversial topics that impact not only communities of color, but students at large. Like, we talked about toxic masculinity. We also talked about the different ways that the media portrays disadvantaged communities and ethnicities, and kind of got to gauge a lot of different perspectives on what people felt and thought about those topics. So, I mean, we definitely are trying to cater as much as we can to the student body, but at the same time, keeping in mind that we need to educate and inform people about topics that they may not be so familiar with.
That's great, Nofa. We're definitely going to miss you when you leave. So, Alicia, I want to talk to you next. I understand it's your third year here. How would you describe AIC's social climate?
So I think I want to first mention or start off with saying that prior to me being here, my position was vacant for about a year. And during that time, and even probably a little bit before, a lot of students, specifically since, you know, this is Black History Month, they were focusing on our Black and brown students, specifically our Black and brown students definitely did not feel seen or heard or validated because they didn't have someone with, like, in this role to be an advocate for them and provide that space for them. So during my first year here, one of the first events that I ever held was an opportunity for students to come to me and tell me, what is missing on campus? What do they need? How can I be, you know, an advocate for them and serve them and provide the best experience possible? And we had, you know, conversations about, you know, being able to have spaces where they can have real, raw, authentic conversations. And from there, we developed the Let's Get Real series that we, you know, I host every year or every semester. We host three different ones every semester, once a month, and we talk about a variety of topics, including, you know, social justice issues, colorism, privilege, discrimination, all, like, just a variety of things. And so for me, it's really important that we provide that space for students so that they can have a platform and share personal experiences that they've gone through, connect with other students, you know, get different perspectives, and just feel heard and seen. And I think by developing the Let's Get Real series, I was also able to invite other individuals that students didn't normally see coming to support them or hear them or validate the things that they were going through. So, you know, we started off with about five or six students, and we've grown to, you know, about 30 people in a room, including not just students, but faculty, staff, administration, that are all here in one space having these conversations. And it makes such an impact on our students, because in that moment you feel like, okay, I'm seeing these individuals outside of office hours, outside of, you know, an appointment that I might have with them. They're coming to these events to hear what I have to say and to share my experience. So I think in that area, we've, you know, definitely improved because we're providing that space for students. However, there's so much more work that we need to do and so many more things that we need to get done, and making sure that, you know, our policies are more inclusive for the students that we have here, you know, not just for Black and brown students, but we're talking about socioeconomic status and, you know, identity and you know, if they identify LGBTQ ability, you know, some of these buildings our students can't access because they're older and they might be disabled and they can't access these spaces. So I think there's a lot of work that we need to do, but I think it's important for us to still acknowledge the growth that we have been able to accomplish thus far.
Right, and I can definitely vouch for the growth. It was my first time attending one of the Let's Get Real series, and I can just tell you right now, like, that was one of the most eye-opening, empowering experiences that I have since I've been at AIC. Even though I am involved in everything, but just having that safe space where you can come and hear perspectives, learn something, and then walk away with something. Mm-hmm. So Mika, it's your second year here, and what do you think about the campus's focus on diversity?
That's kind of it's a complex question and a complex answer. So when I think about what this institution was founded on, it really was about sort of difference as its focus on immigrants and so forth. And over the last several decades, it's a much more diverse institution than it was at the beginning. And I think sometimes when you're living in a very diverse space, you can begin to tell yourself, we've got this diversity thing figured out. And I think what I noticed as soon as I got here was that we do have a very diverse student body, but we haven't yet approximated what inclusion necessarily looks like, and Alicia focused on that a little bit in talking about policies and so forth. And I think on the academic side of the house, I think about courses that see the students in our classes and see their story as part of the knowledge that we're sharing. So teaching from a place of recognizing who the people in your classroom are and ensuring that everyone feels seen, they feel heard, they feel there's a visibility to everyone. And so over the last, it started last year and it's really picked up this year, we've really focused on what's called inclusive pedagogy. So we hired a person to oversee faculty development, and she's a woman of color who really specializes in this area and has created lots of trainings and so forth to work with folks. We recently passed a redesign of our general education curriculum with a focus in there on interdisciplinarity. And so when you think about what interdisciplinarity is, it's taking lots of different ways of looking at a topic. And what the goal of that is very much saying, here's an opportunity for us to see our students and look at lots of different perspectives and make sure visibility and representation is happening. And along the lines of representation, it's, for me, in academic affairs, making sure we always have representative pools. So when you're searching for a candidate, you make sure that you have a pool that looks like the folks that you're working with. So you've got folks of all races, you've got a good sized black and brown population there, and that you're really seeking to hire people who can continue to increase representation in faculty ranks. So, I would say it feels like early days to me, but I think that there's been a lot of movement. And like this semester, I'm working with Melissa McDonald on a class in sociology, the focus being the hate You Give, that movie. And I'm really proud of the conversations that we're having in that class, and the way I am hoping students feel like they matter. Because if you don't feel like you matter, you don't really, there isn't an impetus to continue to study, you know? Mm-hmm.
That's a great observation, Mika. And I just love your responses. I remember last year we had a similar conversation in your office, and you always seem to be spot on and like aware of the things around you and how to be inclusive in a diversity environment like AIC, because it is known as, like, I know people call AIC the HBCU of the North, because we always had like a diverse campus. Even when I came here, I met more people from around the world than anywhere. So I'm very proud to go to a school like this. I want to bring up the lecture from Dr. Yahuru Williams. He came here on February 11th and had a chance to speak to us in the CCA. He gave a brief history of the violence that was used to keep Black African Americans from exercising their rights, focusing on the lynchings. In his presentation, he brought up this concept called the 6 degrees of segregation.
In fact, the 14th Amendment is very clear. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall breach the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States, but by virtue of the Supreme Court's decisions in the civil rights cases of 1883 and Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, you see barriers to equal rights erected in housing, education, access to places of public accommodation, Jim Crow justice, voting rights, and unfair labor practices, what I like to call the 6 degrees of segregation.
So just reiterating the 6 degrees of segregation: housing, education, public accommodation, Jim Crow justice, unfair labor practices, and voting. Which of these areas of life do you guys feel is targeted most for injustice, and why?
For me, I always think about I think about education. And I think that education, the discrimination that happens in education, the segregation that happens in education, is very much a part and parcel of housing and the way we segregate folks based on completely arbitrary measures. And yet what ends up happening is that we, as a result, those folks don't have access to the kind of education that can change their lives, that would prepare them for sort of the next, whatever that next step is. And so it just further compounds and creates generations of folks who don't have access. So when I think about segregation, I always think about it as, you keep those people here, you allow these people to be here, and then the entire experience for people living in this space is completely different from the experience of folks living over in this space. And that affects everything. That affects your healthcare, that affects access to like green spaces and so forth. So I always look at education because I think education is where we free people.
Mm-hmm.
I would definitely agree with the education piece. So that was like, although all of these areas play a very large role, I think I also go back to education for the same, you know, very similar reasons. I mean, when we talk about redlining and when they didn't allow individuals to purchase houses or homes in certain areas based on the color of your skin, and then the idea that the people that were living in those areas where you were trying to move into, the value of their homes would decrease if people of color were allowed into these spaces and able to purchase homes. Although we know that that is not the case and that is not true, that is what was told. And even to the individuals that were selling the homes, so the realtors they could lose their license if they were, you know, showing people of color homes in these areas. And what you see is when you own a house, the taxes and stuff that you pay towards, you know, your home go into a number of different things, but one of those areas being education and providing, you know, updated books and better facilities and, you know, more opportunities. You're able to pay your teachers more, so therefore your the interest for the people, the teachers that are coming in, want to be there, want to stay there, want to work there, and then are providing your children with a better education. And we know when you have education, that's something that no one can take from you, no matter what they say. Mm-hmm. Once you have education, that paper, no one can take that from you. So if you have a strong foundation, then the doors are endless. The doors that may open for you are endless. You can go to different colleges or institutions, you know, wherever it is that you may want to go, but your possibilities are much more, as opposed to if you are in an area like an inner city where you don't have as much. And not that you can't, because I came from an inner city public school. I went to Harding High School in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Okay, so, and that is not the greatest high school. We can be very honest about that. But here I am. So it's not that you can't do it, but there are a lot more barriers that you have to overcome when you are given that as your beginning circumstance. So for me, education is huge, just because with education comes power, and no one can take that away from you.
Agreed. I definitely do agree with everything else that was said prior, and I would have to harp on housing in particular, because I feel like the neighborhood in which you are brought up in definitely plays a huge part in how you are molded or how you develop yourself as a character or being in this life. And living in an impoverished communities, they say some of the three things that you look for are funeral homes, fast food restaurants, and alcohol shops. And it's really interesting when Alicia brought up the point of redlining, how all these things are intentionally placed to oppress people of color, to oppress people in these particular neighborhoods. It's not by chance, it's not, you know, unexpected, really. Everything is done with intention and everything is done with a purpose. So even when people are living in these communities and seeing these trends, and it's kind of like they're forced to normalize these things, and they associate it with their circumstance, or they associate it with the way that they're living because they feel like that's the ceiling for them, that they can't escape, seemingly. So I would definitely harp on housing, that is a big, big thing, and it still impacts a lot of people of color today to those different, I guess, situations.
Thank you, Nofa. So I definitely agree with you guys when you say education and housing. Dr. Williams kind of focused his presentation more on the Jim Crow justice and voting because violence was used as a tool to stop African Americans from exercising their rights. So I wanted to ask, how can we combat these injustices today as students, as young leaders, when we face injustice through housing, through the justice system, through education? What are some tools or ways that we can help uplift our students to face them?
So again, I think I'm gonna go to education. I think if you educate yourself on your history and knowing the history of your people, your culture, your background, and understanding what they've gone through, what they had to face in their situations, it can kind of give you not only a baseline to go to move forward from, it can also inspire you to want to make a difference and want to change. But then it also just, you have that education piece as well. So when you're going forward and you're having these conversations, you're spreading the knowledge to the next person. I mean, I feel like our students want to make a difference, but I don't know if they know exactly where to start. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And I don't know if they really understand some of the issues that even Dr. Williams were bringing up or speaking on, because for some of them, that may have been the very first time that they heard of some of these names or some of these situations or these theories that he was speaking about. And you can't do much when you don't have some type of background. But it's not to say that you can't do anything at all, but I just think that education is a huge piece in that.
Okay, so I want to bring it back to the question. When we ask, how can young leaders begin to combat injustice today, what type of events on campus does Pride or Diversity Education or Academic Affairs are offering for us to help combat and become more aware of these injustices?
For one, every other Monday now since this semester started, Pride holds something called General Board Meetings, which we open it up to students on campus to attend so that we can have conversations about things like this, whether it's like things that are going on in the media right now or things that are impacting us in the news or regarding politics, because most times a lot of students really just don't know. And the importance of informing people and educating people on these topics can really, really play a huge role in the way that they carry themselves later on, or in the way that they just want to get more involved, because the more you know, the more you feel like you have a say, or the more you feel like you can enact change in those areas. So I would definitely say the more that we talk about it, the more that we inform people of these things, the more that it'll inspire them or kind of ignite a light for them to want to change something.
And Mika, I know you mentioned a lot of stuff earlier about the class and stuff. How do you feel like we can combat these injustices?
I think that it's funny because there are lots of different ways that we do it that might not be directly like we're teaching you to combat injustice. But if we operate from the premise that education changes lives, it's an act of resistance, and we think about certain classes where students are learning. So I think about John Nordell teaches classes, you know, his art classes are very, very much about portraying images that people feel sort of bring them to life and are representative of their personal experience. That gives people a voice that they might not have had. I think about Melissa McDonald is regularly sort of known for offering classes that really open up a door into that kind of experience. And I think across the board, I could probably just list a number of teachers who are in their ways helping to do this with students. And then I think, you know, the other piece of this is helping people to feel safe in speaking truth to power. Mm-hmm. And that's a culture shift that probably needs to happen everywhere, right? But at an institution where you have, any institution is gonna have a power differential, right? So we have this opportunity to say, my space is safe for you to come and share your experience, and let's try and kind of like work together to find resolution. And the reason I feel strongly about this is because I've had so many conversations with students where students will say, yeah, this happened, but you know what? I don't want to do anything about it. Like, I feel too uncomfortable to do something about it. And the gift that we give students in those spaces is to say, let me broker a conversation with you and this coach or this faculty member or this administrator or you know, somebody in campus police, so that you get to speak your voice and do it in a way that you can be heard. And this person, whoever is hearing it, gets to hear and then share their thoughts. And then you have dialogue and both sides are kind of humanized, and hopefully change comes out of that. So I think that our job in academic affairs is to create those kinds of spaces. And I think it's happening in places, and we just want to do more and more of that.
Mm-hmm. All right. What about you, Alicia?
So I definitely agree with both statements. And I think, you know, something that Mika pointed out too was that it's our responsibility. For example, I'm speaking from the staff side. It's our responsibility to provide these safe and inclusive spaces where we can empower you all, depending on whatever situations you may be going through or may be dealing with. And allowing you to feel your feels. Mm-hmm. I use that so much because we like tend to try not to feel our feels and push them down, but acknowledge what you feel. Acknowledge that what happened was not okay, and let's talk about it. Let's have some conversation. How can I support you? What steps can we take moving forward? What meetings do we need to set up? Who do we need to talk to get this situated? But I think the other thing too on top of that is that we all, and now I'm speaking as like AIC and students included, we also need to be very intentional with what we're feeding ourselves. So I'll use social media, for example. There's a ton of garbage on social media, but then there's a ton of great stuff. And yes, we like to watch the entertaining things that, you know, that are just that, entertaining, but I think it's also important that we have just as much real information coming to us, so how we can stay abreast of things that are going on in society and so forth. And then now it's our responsibility, now that we know about things that are going on, now it's our responsibility to have those conversations. The same way that we would talk to our best friend about whatever happened on Love and Hip Hop is the same way that we need to be discussing the things that we're reading in the news and all these different articles and stuff like that with our peers, to educate each other and hold each other accountable as well.
Right. That was so powerful to say, and I hope it inspired anyone who's listening today. I'm so glad we got to talk about all of these subjects, especially with it being Black History Month and with all of the new events and stuff that we have on campus. And people tend to measure things in terms of impact and stuff, but it's only people who go out and actually participate in our democracy as an American citizen, like, that are able to make incremental change over time. So it's like, yes, we have these conversations, we have these events on campus, but making sure we're participating in the community around us as a whole to bring everybody back up. Mm-hmm. So I want to say thank you guys for coming to this podcast. This was such a great experience. Make sure you guys tune in to Catch the Buzz in the Hum in the Hive. Thanks. Hi, listeners. The AIC Radio Club and the Yellow Jacket newspaper are collaborating on a podcast theme song contest, calling all musicians, rappers, hip-hop artists, beatboxers, singers, and songwriters. Anyone who's interested should adhere to the following requirements. Your work must be original student work, and your submission should be at least 30 to 60 seconds long. Everyone should send in their submissions by at least March 20th and send that right in to William Stephan. That's william.stephan@aic.edu, WILLIAM.STEFFEN@aic.edu. And the deadline is March 20th. We hope to hear from you soon. Thanks. Welcome back to The Hum in the Hive. I am your host, Ave Mullen, and we are back with special guest Professor Gary Jones, a historian on modern American history. He's here to give us some historical context and perspective about the civil rights movement and how it impacts our society today. In the earlier segment of the podcast, I brought up the lecture with Dr. Yahuru Williams. It focused on participatory democracy for African Americans, and he brought up this concept called the 6 degrees of segregation, which are basically 6 areas of life where injustices are targeted. Those 6 degrees are housing, education, public accommodation, Jim Crow justice, unfair labor practices, and voting. Professor Jones, I want to know, from a historian's point of view, which areas of life do you think will be the next focus for progress?
I think maybe rather than thinking about the next focus for progress, or maybe that can be appropriate, I would say right now it's mass incarceration and police killings. Those are the issues of the moment. So that's probably where the most important organizing is right now. The only other issue, of course, is the right to vote, and that, of course, is under attack as well. Because what usually I would argue that what passes for laws to prevent voter fraud is actually voter suppression, you know, and that those laws target the young, the poor, and people of color in particular.
Okay, and that's definitely what Dr. Yeho Williams was talking about. And Will brought up an interesting point saying how the terminology for 6 degrees of segregation, it might be related to the movie 6 degrees of separation, which just shows like no matter what class or race you is, we're all ultimately affected by injustices if it happens through voting, through Jim Crow justice, or through education. I want to touch on the tweet from Donald Trump where he referred to the impeachment as a lynching. He tweeted, "So someday, if a Democrat becomes president and the Republicans win the House, even by a tiny margin, they can impeach the president without due process or fairness or any legal rights. All Republicans must remember what they are witnessing here, a lynching, but we will win." I want to know, why is this problematic for him to use this word, and are there any other instances where the use of a word with historical context can be problematic?
Well, with regards to lynching, the process of impeachment, which of course is in the Constitution, and the founding fathers like Alexander Hamilton wrote about impeachment in the Federalist Papers. And in actual fact, I would go so far as to say, although it might sound like I'm exaggerating, that the constitutional, legal, political process of impeachment is probably the exact opposite of lynching, the exact opposite. It's in the Constitution, there are precedents, there's a process, and it's the exact opposite. I mean, President Donald Trump was provided with every right during the process of his impeachment, for which he was not found guilty and removed from office, every right that was accorded to him by the Constitution and convention and tradition and precedent. On the contrary, a lynching is a criminal act. It's murder by mob. So I don't want to sound as though I'm exaggerating, but it was really outrageous that he would use the word and the phrase and the concept of lynching to describe what was happening to himself.
Are there any other instances where the use of a word with historical context can be problematic? I know we spoke about Liz Pryor in her article about the use of the N-word.
Yes, Liz Pryor, who spoke here, in 2019, and she's going to come back in 2021, actually, in March 21, when she's finished her book. Mm-hmm. And she'll be talking about this subject again on our campus. But the N-word, I mean, it's very interesting. Her research has shown, you know, that the N-word, like everything else, has a history. And the N-word doesn't date back to the South in the 1600s. The use of the N-word as a derogatory slur to African Americans dates back to the North in the 1820s, when there was a growing free black community and whites were felt anxious, insecure, and challenged by the rise of a free black community. And what was to be the relationship between whites and an enslaved African American was clear. But what was to be the relationship between free blacks and whites? Mm-hmm. And of course, the word continues to be controversial. I think Dr. Pryor would never say to any person, any African American person, you know, that he or she should not use that word. I think she herself she herself doesn't use it and would sort of argue or counsel against its use, not just by whites, but by African Americans themselves. Mm-hmm. And she posed the question the last time she came to campus as to why something like 150 years after the abolition of slavery, African Americans themselves would use a word that was that really proliferated and has been perpetuated, and use a word that's origins are a deliberate slur and denigration of African Americans. So, of course, there's the discussion, you know, why white people should not use the N-word. But she's focusing more, I think, and you would think that would be self-evident, although it's not. She's focusing more on perhaps the use of the word among African Americans, mm-hmm. and she would counsel against it, although she would never, she's not trying to critique or condemn other African Americans. And, you know, and she is a sophisticated thinker and person, mm-hmm. so she realizes it can be used even by African Americans to each other in different ways. Mm-hmm. But that's another example of a, you quite rightly point out that, that the N-word, like lynching, is another word that because of the tragic side of American history with regards to slavery, segregation, the old Jim Crow, Jane Crow segregation, maybe the new Jim Crow segregation. It's just freighted with sort of tragedy and trauma. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's another side to African American history, the African American past and present and future, which in many ways it is triumphant.
Right.
But certainly words like the N-word and to use the N-word, excuse me, at all, and to use lynching other than it as a word that described a heinous practice from the 1880s to the 1950s, excuse me, or even beyond, to use it for political purposes as the present did is, you know, just not admirable at all.
Right.
There's no defense for it.
Right, and I'm glad, I like the way that you touched on that because it just shows the difference between the two words and how the historical context of the words affects how we use it today. So just knowing the distinction. So lastly, I want to bring up the example of George White and Savannah Smith. George White was guilty of murdering a 17-year-old girl, but before he had his right to a fair trial, an angry mob of about 5,000 people captured him and burned him at the stake. Decades later, a student by the name of Savannah Smith heard of his story and wanted to create a historical marker in his honor. But because he was guilty in the situation, about 3 days later, the marker was taken down. I want to ask you, what do you suggest are some efficient ways that young leaders can bring awareness and involvement to their campus about historical injustices?
Oh, that's a good question. One way is, first of all, to learn about history mm-hmm. and the historical injustices. And sort of the scale and the scope, talking about racial inequality and the denial of freedom. I mean, 245 years of slavery, 75 years of Jim Crow, you know, 50 years of urban dwelling and working, and now mass incarceration and police killings. There's a long history of tragedy mm-hmm. with regards to racial equality in America. First of all, just learning that history, acquiring a college degree, obviously, and a diploma from a 4-year college helps with an occupation and a career. But students select a particular major that will lead to a occupation or a career, we would hope, and more often than not does, and it's a huge benefit. But I think we lose, when we're so concerned particularly about sort of the cost of an education, we lose sight of the value of an education. Mm-hmm. And I actually think learning about the acquisition of knowledge, and in this case, learning about history, and despite the rhetoric of freedom and equality in America, there's a long history of the denial of freedom and of inequality, whether it's class or race or gender. And just learning that history can be tremendously useful and empowering.
Right.
And I think it's a historian that Professor Dr. Williams quoted, John Hope Franklin. He had made a famous comment, and he said that good history is the foundation for a good history is a good foundation for a better present and future. So the first thing is learning the history. And sharing it, I think, in whatever context it's possible to share it in.
Right.
Such as, for example, the way you use radio, you know. Mm-hmm. That's a great example. So first and foremost, I'd say sort of learn the history. To quote Mark Twain that Professor Williams mentioned in his recent talk here at AIC, when he mentioned Mark Twain's essay, The United States of Lynchedom, Mark Twain used to say, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. So history has to be used carefully, but it can impart valuable lessons.
Right.
One of which, I would say, with African-American history is, and I'm not unique in thinking this or arguing this at all, many historians like Thomas Holt have made this point, that if you look at the long span of African-American history and their emergence as a people, there's slavery, but then there's emancipation and Reconstruction and equality. And then there's a reaction, which is Jim Crow and Jane Crow. And then there's the emergence of civil rights and black power, which was sometimes seen as the second Reconstruction, right? Civil rights advocates were sometimes referred to as the new abolitionists, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's, according to Michelle Alexander, there's another racial reaction. And she argues that is mass incarceration of black youth, mm-hmm. male and female, particularly male. And the vehicle for that was the war on drugs and the over-policing of people of color and the under-policing of whites.
Right.
And that has led to mass incarceration, but people of color are disproportionately represented way beyond their presence in the larger population behind walls and bars. So that's, circling round to what we began with, that's one of the big issues.
Mm-hmm.
As Angela Davis would say, not just prison reform, but the abolition of incarceration.
And that perfectly goes back to our question, is how can students effectively bring awareness and involvement by learning the history and going back and seeing those patterns in the government and stuff, so we better are equipped with the knowledge to face them today. Because like you said, history doesn't repeat itself, but there are rhymes. So it's like there's clues in the past to help us deal with the things that are coming up today. But I want to thank you so much for your input. It was really helpful for our podcast on African American history and Black History Month. I want to thank you again, and make sure you guys tune in next month for The Hum in the Hive. Thank you. Hi guys. Thanks so much for listening to our first podcast of The Hum in the Hive. We want to give a special thanks to William Steffen, who oversees the Yellow Jacket newspaper and really helped us put this whole thing together. Secondly, we want to give a special shout out to Yoshika Cousins, who was president of AIC Radio and gave us access to the studio and even trained us on the software. Last but not least, we want to give a shout out to Marty Langford, who really helped us put this whole thing together, gave us lots of support, sound checks, and all the equipment that we needed. And thanks again to all of our listeners for listening to our first podcast. We hope you guys tune in again. Thanks.